Chapter 21. Lawyers Laud and Denounce Frank. In an eloquent speech, replete with word pictures, sometimes sarcastic, sometimes pathetic, sometimes humorous, but at all times dramatic, Attorney Frank A. Hooper, Thursday morning, opened the state's argument for the conviction of Leo M. Frank for the murder of Mary Fagan. He commenced days of oratory unparalleled in the history of Georgia. Mr. Hooper began his speech by declaring to the jury that the state was not seeking a verdict of guilty unless the defendant was guilty, and that the state cheerfully assumed the burden of proving him guilty. "This man," he said, pointing to Frank, "should not be convicted because the law is seeking a victim. We are not looking for blood. We are simply seeking to find and punish the murderer of little Mary Fagan." Mr. Hooper scored the conditions existing at the pencil factory, called attention to the fact that after many witnesses had sworn that Frank's character was bad, the defense had failed to interrogate them as to why they held such opinions. He described the defendant as a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, a man who was congenial with two widely different sets of associates. Mr. Hooper declared that Jim Conley had stood like Stone Mountain in the face of the terrific bombardment directed at him by Attorney Rosser in an effort to break him down. "The effort failed," said the speaker, "because Conley had, after telling many lies, eventually arrived at the truth." Perhaps the most dramatic portion of Mr. Hooper's speech was when he said, "Give the defendant the benefit of every doubt. The circumstances show that he either killed this little girl or sat there in his office and let the Negro kill her and drag her body down the hall to the elevator and take it down to the basement. This murder took place in the metal room, and it occurred while Montine Stover was in Frank's office." Mr. Hooper reminded the jury that although Frank had sworn that he did not leave his office between 12 and 1 o'clock, the Stover girl had gone there during that period and found the office empty. "I don't believe Frank had murder in his heart when he followed Mary Fagan back into the metal room," said Mr. Hooper, "but he had in his heart the lustful passions stored up for this little girl. He was killing her when Montine Stover came to the office." Hooper touched on the evidence only in a general way. He dealt more with the law. He defined the reasonable doubt, told the jury of the value of character testimony, of the worth of circumstantial evidence. Attorney Hooper occupied less time than any of the others who followed him. Attorney Arnold, who succeeded him on the floor, argued 4 hours and 40 minutes, and Luther Rosser took exactly the same time. Solicitor Dorsey talked between 11 and 12 hours, making one of the longest speeches ever made by a prosecutor in a criminal case in the South. A wonderfully persuasive and convincing speaker, Mr. Arnold was perhaps never more effective than in the Frank trial. He spoke deliberately, choosing his words, pausing for emphasis, and the gestures of a master actor could not have been more dramatic. His tall form enabling him to see and be seen from every corner of the courtroom, the peculiar resonant quality of his voice rising high above all other sounds, he caught and held the attention of spectators and jury alike with the magic of his eloquence. He started by picturing the jury as set above and apart from the public, sequestered, guarded, reading no papers, and hearing nothing of the public discussion of the trial, in order that they may impartially weigh the evidence and make up their verdict without bias or prejudice. Then, turning to address the courtroom rather than the jury, Attorney Arnold excoriated the long-tongued, loud-talking sapheads who immediately conclude that a man is guilty the moment the finger of suspicion is directed toward him. He denounced those who would punish the defendant for no other reason than that he is a Jew. He declared that if Frank had not been a Jew, he never would have been prosecuted. He paid his respects to the jury by saying they are way above the average. "I'm not saying this to flatter you," said he. "I reckon I have tried cases before 1,000 judges, and I'm telling you the simple truth. Leo Frank comes from a race of people that have made money," he said, "and that has made some people envious. I tell everybody, all within hearing of my voice, that if he hadn't been a Jew, he would never have been prosecuted. That Negro Conley has been brought into court to tell his own tale, not corroborated, but prompted. I am asking my kind of people to give this man fair play. Before I'd do a Jew an injustice, I'd want my throat cut from ear to ear. This is a case that they've built up by degrees. They've got a monstrous perjurer here by the name of Conley, and they brought a man up here who before this crime nobody had ever said a word against, and asked you to believe this Negro against him. There is always such evidence in a criminal case, and always a premonition of such evidence. After the trial was in progress 2 or 3 weeks, they got a lot of floaters, and they testified. In my criminal experience, I've seen a lot of such witnesses. I don't know whether it's imagination that makes them do it, but there is a certain class that is always ready to offer evidence. We've got a lot in this case that shouldn't be in. It's been put in to prejudice your mind against the defendant." He took up every detail of the state's theory, and with powerful logic undertook to show that this theory is unreasonable and absurd. Then, as to Conley, if he had been the solicitor and the Negro had been the defendant charged with the murder of Mary Fagan, Attorney Arnold could not have surpassed himself in trying to convince the jury of Conley's guilt. He argued that the brutal manner in which Mary Fagan was killed is characteristic of a Negro. "This man," said he of Frank, "does not come of a violent race." He argued that Conley's opportunity for killing the girl was vastly better than Frank's opportunity. His theory, constructed with consummate skill, was this: that Conley, on Saturday morning, was half drunk, his passions inflamed, crazy for money, that he lurked in the dark passageway on the first floor, at the foot of the stairs, according to his own admission, that he watched with greedy eyes every woman and girl who passed, as shown by his describing on the witness stand in minute detail the kinds of dresses and shoes worn by the girls, that Mary Fagan came down the stairs with her mesh bag in her hand, that Conley grabbed it, she refused to turn it loose and screamed, he struck her the blow over the left eye and knocked her down, and she got the blow on the back of her head as she fell, that Conley dropped her body through the elevator shaft, hung around the factory until Frank left, went down into the basement, and finished his brutal work, that then, finding the front door locked, and also being afraid to show himself on the front, broke open the back door of the basement and went his way. The law is that before a man can be convicted on circumstantial evidence, the circumstances must be so strong as to exclude every other reasonable hypothesis except that of the guilt of the accused. If Attorney Arnold himself had laid down this principle to fit his case, he could not have made it fit the case more perfectly to suit his immediate purpose of clearing Frank. His job was to convince the jury that Mary Fagan's murder can be explained just as easily, if not more easily, on the theory that Conley did it, as on the theory that Frank did it. "Suspicion," he said, "first was directed to Frank because he was the only man in the factory. He was the only man who had an opportunity to do it. Denham and White were on the fourth floor, and probably Mrs. White, too. They say they don't know anything about it, and I don't believe they do. Nobody knew anybody was down by the elevator hole, the most favorable part of the factory for a crime.
until long after Frank had been arrested. It did not crop up for weeks, but by that time the police were after Frank. First they started on Newt Lee. If he had been a weak and yielding Negro, and had seen he could get favor from the police by telling a fairy tale on Frank, the police would have thought they had put a feather in their cap. Mr. Starnes may think he is working for truth and justice, but I don't think so. It's like that decision from the Court of Appeals that I read to you this morning. Evidence gained by persecution or torture or the third degree is dangerous evidence. I don't believe Starnes or Black would write out something and say, swear to that, but they didn't have to. Conley can construct a whole story simply because they said to him, you can't swear to that, nobody will believe you. I've heard people say that Conley couldn't have thought this up. He didn't have the imagination. Everybody who has ever been around a courthouse knows that Negroes, like children, have an unlimited capacity for imagination. My friend Hooper this morning said, how did he know this much about Frank? He pointed to that word, chat. Why, everybody knows that Negroes mock their bosses and try to learn their expressions. I've seen three or four of them together trying to talk like their boss does. As that Negro lay in his cell at the police station, he conjured up the story that he has told, and it was monstrous. I don't suppose much was thought of it when Conley said he couldn't write. A lot of Negroes can't. But then they found the pawn tickets after 2 or 3 weeks. The writing on them was identical with the writing on the notes. They confronted Jim with it, and finally he admitted it. As soon as he copied off the notes, it was apparent that he wrote the originals. Seeing he was caught, he finally made his first miserable confession. He was conjuring up a plot to save himself. He had weeks and weeks to do it. He knew they were trying to make a case against Frank. He knew they were trying to indict Frank. It was the most natural thing in the world for him to put the blame on Frank. And he had smooth sailing in doing it. When he did it, he said he did it because Frank wouldn't stick to him. I don't suppose in criminal annals a prisoner ever had a better chance to lay a crime on another than here. And he had earnest hearers. These detectives were afraid they would be criticized if they did not press the case against Frank. He was a well-known man. I am partisan, gentlemen, and I admit it. And the solicitor says that he is not. God knows, gentlemen, I've never heard such partisanship in any court before. I never heard a solicitor general, sworn to enforce the law impartially, say, I'll go as far as the court will let me, when checked by the court. How far did he go out of court? Nobody but God will ever know. And if the length the solicitor general, that high official, has gone, can be measured only by the infinite, to what length do you suppose these detectives went? There is only one other man besides Dalton who said that he, Dalton, had been to the factory with a woman. And he said that Dalton went into the factory with a woman between 1 and 2 o'clock, when Frank was always at lunch. This man, and I have no reason to believe he was not telling the truth, says he only saw Dalton enter the front door, and does not know where he went inside the building. That was at a time when the same entrance was used by the Clark Woodenware Company and by the pencil factory. But, gentlemen, I am prepared to admit that Dalton left an oozy trail of a serpent, whether he went to the factory or to the Woodenware Company. Now, gentlemen, is there anything else except the incidents where Frank was connected? And I'm coming to that later. Against the factory? Is there anything indecent? Anything that would make it different from other factories? Think of a factory that had on it the keen eyes of Starnes, who stops at nothing, the watchful eyes of Black, whom I love and who I want to put my arms around every time I see him, and the eagle eyes of Pat Campbell, who didn't dare go on the stand for fear I'd ask him how he got those statements from Conley, and the eyes of Scott, who was one of that lovely quartet. Is there a factory in Georgia that could stand the searching probe which they gave this one? Let us see. In the first place, we've had a mighty upheaval in Atlanta in the last year or two. My friend Beavers has written a new decalogue, and he has searched the town with a fine-tooth comb, hunting for wrongdoers. He has put on a vice squad. I was near saying an immoral squad, but I won't. A vice squad has been searching the city for every louse on the head of the body politic. Had this factory been polluted, would it have escaped? Would Schiff over there, or Dalton, or any one of 100 others be at large today, if they had been running a disorderly house in that factory? One of the cruelest things that my friend Hooper said, and he doesn't want to be cruel, he is so mild that he can't do much harm, was that the evidence showed that Schiff and Darley were immoral. There's not a thing to show guilt or misconduct on the part of that man Schiff, not a line of evidence. Solicitor Hugh M. Dorsey's speech was the most remarkable of the trial. He was on the floor more than 11 hours and talked on parts of 3 different days. Beginning when Attorney Rosser closed Friday afternoon, he talked until adjournment, resumed again Saturday morning, and spoke without a stop until 2 o'clock in the afternoon, when the court recessed until Monday morning. On Monday, he resumed his argument and did not complete his address until noon. The principal reason for the long adjournment was the fear of returning a verdict on Saturday night, with the center of town flooded with people. Dorsey covered every point of the case fully and faithfully. He clenched every fact he had brought out, and his arraignment of Frank was probably the most bitter that has ever been aimed at a defendant in a murder trial in the whole country. He termed him a man with a reputation but no character, as a man not like other men, and likened him to Oscar Wilde, the famous literary genius, to Durant, the famous San Francisco slayer, and to Pastor Richeson of Boston. Every time he emerged from the building, Dorsey was greeted with plaudits. The bulk of the people commended his attitude and his wonderful effort to make sure of the conviction of the young factory superintendent. This is not only an important case. It is an extraordinary case. The crime was extraordinary. An awful crime, a most heinous crime, the crime of a demoniac. The crime demanded vigilant, earnest, conscientious effort on the part of your detectives and on my part, and it demands earnest consideration on your part. It is important because of the importance, standing, and ability of counsel pitted against us. 4 of them, Messrs. Arnold and Rosser, and the 2 Messrs. Haas. Extraordinary because of the defendant. Extraordinary because of the manner in which these gentlemen have argued the case. Mr. Rosser, the rider of the wind and stirrer of the storm, and Mr. Arnold, as mild a mannered man as ever cut a throat or scuttled a ship. They have conducted themselves extraordinarily. They have maligned and abused me and the detectives. They heaped calumny on me to such an extent that the good mother of the defendant here arose and in this presence denounced me as a dog. It is an old adage, and it is true, that no thief ever felt the halter draw with a good opinion of the law. Turning toward the defendant and his party of friends, Mr. Dorsey continued, "I don't want your good opinion. I neither ask it nor seek it, and if you did give it to me, I would doubt my own honesty." "Prejudice and perjury," says Mr. Arnold. And then they use that stereotyped phrase, "It fatigues my indignation," to argue this case. Don't let this precious indignation disturb your nerve and deter you from your duty. They ought to have been indignant. They have been paid to play the part. "Prejudice and perjury," they say, gentlemen. Do you think that I or the detectives have been actuated by prejudice? Would we, sworn officers of the law, have sought to hang this man because of racial and religious prejudice, and passed up Jim Connolly, a Negro? Prejudice! When Gant was arrested and then released, when Lee was arrested and exonerated, but when you get Frank, you get prejudice, they say. Let us see. They were disappointed. The case was not pitched on the fact that this defendant is a Jew. By no word or act in this case have we indicated that he was Jew or Gentile, or black or white. We would have despised ourselves if we had asked for conviction on account of prejudice. The first time prejudice was brought into the case, it was brought in by them, and brought in for a purpose. Never have I seen two men so delighted as Rossa and Arnold when they put those questions to Kenley. Never will I forget that scene. We did not put it in, and prejudice is not in this case. Mark you, they, not us, raised the cry of prejudice. I say here and now, the race from which this defendant comes is as good as ours. His ancestors were civilized when ours were eating human flesh. I honor the race that produced Disraeli. I honor the race that produced J.P. Benjamin, as great a lawyer as ever lived in America or England. And he lived in both. I honor Strauss, the diplomat, and the man who went down with the Titanic. I roomed with a man of this defendant's race at college, and one of them is my business partner. I honor Rabbi Mark, and I listen to him with pleasure and pride. But, gentlemen, when Becker wished to put to death Rosenthal, it was men of Rosenthal's race that he sought for his purpose. Abe Hummel has died in New York, and Abe Roof in San Francisco, and Swartz has paid the penalty for stabbing a little girl. These things show you that this great people are amenable to the same laws as you and I, and the same laws as an African. This defendant has not a good character, I submit. He has a good reputation among the people who do not know his real character. But suppose he had a good character. That amounts to nothing. David of old was a great character until he put old Uriah into the forefront of a great battle so he would be killed and David could take his wife. Benedict Arnold was brave. He enjoyed the confidence of all the people and those in charge of the Revolutionary War until he betrayed his country. Oscar Wilde, an Irish knight, a literary man, brilliant, the author of works that will go down through the ages, a man who had the effrontery, when the Marquis of Queensberry thought there was something wrong between Wilde and the son of the Marquis, to withstand one of the greatest cross-examinations on record. Oscar Wilde, that man, bore a good reputation until he was proven guilty. Wherever the English language is read, the coolness of that man who underwent the cross-examination of those able lawyers will remain forever a study for lawyers. Not even Oscar Wilde's wife nor his children knew of his perversion, and it never would have been discovered had not one man had the boldness to start an investigation that eventually sent him to prison. He was a literary man, whose cross-examination is a thing to be read with admiration. But he was convicted, and in his tottering old age he confessed. He is the man who raised the sunflower from the rank of weed to that of flower. But he was a pervert, a man of previous good character, Abe Roof of San Francisco, a man of his religion, was of previous good character, but he corrupted Smith and everything that he came in touch with. Roof's career terminated in the penitentiary eventually. Good character isn't worth a cent, gentlemen, if you've got a case proved against you. And crime doesn't only go with the poor. The ignorant, like Jim Conley, commit small crimes. But a man of high intellect sometimes commits a big one. An intellect which, if directed in the right line, would bring honor and glory, but which, if not so directed, drags a man down to the depths, as in the case of this defendant before you. Look at McCune, the mayor of Charlottesville, Virginia. Notwithstanding his good reputation, he did not have a rock bed of character. Tiring of his wife, he shot her in the back as she was in the bathtub. and a jury of brave Virginians sent him to a felon's grave. He had the respect of the people. Richeson of Boston was a preacher, and enjoyed the confidence of his flock. He was engaged to marry a fascinating young woman of Boston, but he was entangled with another young woman, of whom he wanted to rid himself, and he forgot himself so far as to murder. All these cases were decided on circumstantial evidence. After Richeson had fought through the courts, he hoped that a governor would save his life. But a Massachusetts jury and a Massachusetts governor were brave enough to make him pay the lawful penalty for his crime. That's an example to encourage every right-thinking man. Henry Clay Beatty, a man of splendid family, a man of wealthy family, proved his character. Although he didn't possess it, he took his wife, the mother of a 12-month-old baby, out for an automobile ride and shot her in cold blood. Yet that man, looking at the blood in the automobile, joked. He was cool and calm, but he joked too much. The detectives in that case, as in this case, were maligned and abused. There was a slush fund to save him from the gallows, but a jury of Virginia farmers sent him to his doom and put the citizenry of that great commonwealth on a higher plane. Beatty never confessed, but left a note to be read after he was dead, in which he admitted the crime charged against him. Then there was Crippen of England. He was a doctor, a man of high standing, a man of unblemished reputation. He killed his wife because of an infatuation for another woman. He hid her body away where he thought, as this man thought, that it would never be discovered. But murder will out. The body was discovered, and Crippen was executed to the glory of old England. Gentlemen, you have an opportunity that comes to few men. Measure up to it. You say that Conley has been impeached. I say that he has not been impeached, except by those with their hands in the till of the National Pencil Factory. His general character is unimpeached, except by the words of the hirelings of the National Pencil Factory. Yet you would say that he committed this crime when all you have been able to bring up against him, despite the fact that they have interviewed all of his former employers, is that he has been locked up in a police station on the charge of disorderly conduct. Is Conley sustained? Yes, abundantly. Our proof of the general bad character of Frank sustains Jim Conley. Your failure to examine these harebrained fanatics, as Mr. Arnold calls them, without rhyme or reason, sustains Jim Conley. His relations with Miss Rebecca Carson, who is shown to have gone to the dressing room with him, sustain Jim Conley. Your own witness, Miss Jackson, says that this libertine and rake went into the dressing room and stood with a sardonic grin. She sustains Jim Conley. And Miss Kitchens, who worked on the fourth floor, and whom you did not produce by her statement of how he went into the dressing room, sustains Jim Conley. Darley and Miss Mattie Smith, as to what they did April 26, sustain Jim Conley. Truman McCrary, the Negro whom you praise and who gets his living from the pencil factory, sustains Jim Conley as to where he put those sacks. Montine Stover, who went in just at the minute that Frank was back in the metal room with the poor, unfortunate girl, sustains Jim Conley by the statement of the kind of shoes she wore. Montine Stover, when she says that nobody was in the office, sustains Jim Conley as to a statement that he heard the footsteps of two people going back. Lemmy Quinn, your own dear Lemmy, when his statement is taken with the evidence of Miss Hall and Mrs. Freeman, sustains Jim Conley. Dalton, whose character for the past 10 years we have sustained, sustains Jim Conley about previous Saturdays. Daisy Hopkins, by her awful reputation, sustains Jim Conley. The blood on the second floor sustains Jim Conley. the testimony of Holloway, as given in an affidavit to me, and Boots Rogers' statement that the elevator box was unlocked, both sustained Jim Conley. Ivy Jones, whom he met near the factory, sustains Jim Conley. Albert McKnight, who testified as to the time Frank reached home and the time he left, sustains Jim Conley. The repudiated affidavit of McNola McKnight, whose attorney let her sign it when he knew he could get her out on a habeas corpus, sustains Jim Conley. The noose in that cord sustains Jim Conley. The existence of the notes alone sustains Jim Conley, because no Negro in the history of the race ever wrote a note to cover a crime. The character of words used in the notes sustains Jim Conley. Take up the context. The note said she was assaulted when she went back for a natural purpose, and the only toilet Mary knew was in the metal room on the second floor. The fact that the note said the Negro did this by himself showed a conscious effort to limit the crime. Frank, by his own statement, sustains Jim Conley, as to the time of his arrival at the office, the time of his visit to the Montags, and as to the fact that he carried a folder in his hand. Arthur White, according to his statement, borrowed $2 in the afternoon. Where is the entry to show that Frank put down that loan? The fact that there is no entry sustains Jim Conley in his description that Frank's mind was burdened with the problem of disposing of the body. Frank said, "We found it better to get a voucher book and let everybody sign for what money they got." Notwithstanding that, they failed or refused to produce a record showing that White ever got that money. I'll tell you the reason why he didn't enter it. It was because his mind and conscience were on the crime he had just committed. You tell me that this expert bookkeeper, this Cornell graduate, would have overlooked that. There is only one reason why he did. Conley is sustained by Frank when Conley says he remarked that he had relatives in Brooklyn. When old Jim was on the stand, Mr. Rosser asked him about Mincy. Is Mincy a myth, or is he such a diabolical perjurer that it would nauseate the stomach of you gentlemen to produce him before you? Turning to Mr. Arnold and Mr. Rosser, if you weren't going to produce Mincy, why did you parade him before the jury? Gentlemen, every act of that defendant proclaims him guilty. Every word proclaims his knowledge of the death of little Mary Fagan. Every circumstance proves him responsible for the murder of that little girl. Remarkable? Yes, but true. She died a noble death without a stain on her name. She wouldn't yield her virtue to her superintendent, and he strangled her and killed her. In the language of Daniel Webster, when a jury, through whimsical and unfounded scruples, fails to do its full duty, it violates its oath. What happened to her mesh bag? I wouldn't be surprised if it disappeared in the same way that the stick on the first floor and the bloody shirt at Newt Lee's house made their appearance. The first thing he did when he had gagged the little girl with her own underskirt, when he had gagged this little girl who went to her death for her honor. A terrific, piercing scream from Mrs. Coleman interrupted. The mother of the dead girl cried very audibly and was not quieted for several minutes. Mrs. Lucille Frank, wife of the accused, and Mrs. Ray Frank, his mother, both covered their eyes with their hands and appeared to be affected.